It's Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the FDA has authorized a second COVID booster for people over 50. We'll talk about who needs it and get the latest science. But first, when American and other world governments began sanctioning, freezing, and seizing assets of Russian oligarchs in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it highlighted the size and scope of where this incredible wealth is laid around the globe. And this story may draw more attention, as our next guest will explain, to the hidden worldwide system of taking one country's dirty money and relocating it to clean and hide it. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. What do you want to know about global money laundering? Who's doing it? How they're getting away with it? What's being done to stop it? What comes to mind when we say the word kleptocracy? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, ideas@wpr.org. We have with us Casey Michelle, a writer, analyst, and investigative journalist with a background in Russia, Eurasia, and Eastern Europe studies. He's also an adjunct fellow with the Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative. His latest book is called American Kleptocracy: How the U.S. Created the World's Greatest Money Laundering Scheme in History. Casey, welcome to Central Time.
Molly, thanks so much for having me.
Well, can we just start with the word kleptocracy? What does it mean to you when you say that?
Yeah, sure, Molly. That's a great question. You know, if we think about the term kleptocracy, literally, it literally means rule of thieves. We think of kleptos, we think of ocracy. You see where the term actually comes from. And in many ways, you can still use that term to describe so many governments, so many regimes and dictatorships around the world that seem to be dedicated only to enriching themselves, their friends, their inner circles, their cronies, and not in things like democracy or development in and of itself. And we can certainly still use kleptocracy to mean some of these regimes, especially, I think, in places like Russia, as we've seen so clearly over the past few years and certainly in the past month. When I'm writing about kleptocracies, though, and this is really what we've seen over the past maybe decade, maybe two decades at this point, as we have this kind of greater awareness of how the broader offshoring and financial secrecy economy works. You know, when I'm writing about kleptocracy, I'm not writing about one government or one regime elsewhere. I'm talking about an international, transnational phenomenon that sees these kleptocratic regimes, these oligarchs, these dictators, not keep their money in those original countries, but instead move that money elsewhere, move that money across borders, across countries, across entire hemispheres in some cases, and all too often bring it in to places like the United States of America. And this uses a bunch of different industries and loopholes and exemptions. But when I'm talking about kleptocracy, and when others are talking about this term these days, we're not talking about one country or one regime. We're talking about a multi-jurisdictional, transnational phenomenon that sees, in some estimates, trillions of dollars simply looted from some countries by some regimes and then moved elsewhere. It's no longer just one country or one dictator. This is now a global phenomenon.
And you write that America is really the global magnet for this. How did that come to be?
Yeah, boy, Molly, that's a great question. That was kind of the reason that I wrote the book in and of itself, because I think when a lot of folks think of, you know, these offshoring economies, these offshoring jurisdictions or financial secrecy jurisdictions that are the really the core countries, the core areas that are hiding, laundering so much of this money. You know, I think a lot of folks still think of these kind of traditional, literally offshore places, you know, these small islands in the Caribbean, these small places in the South Pacific or in the Mediterranean. Without realizing this transformation over the past decade, two decades, three decades, especially since the end of the Cold War, when it has been these Western countries and especially places like the United States of America that now provide so many of these traditionally offshore services in a very real way. Places like the U.S. have brought these traditionally offshoring services back onshore. We haven't really come up with a good term to really capture that. But when I'm talking about this American transformation, I'm talking about things like the American anonymous shell company industry. I'm talking about things like the American trust industry. I'm talking about things like the American real estate and luxury goods and private equity and hedge fund industries. all of these different industries, some of which are worth tens of trillions of dollars, that have no anti-money laundering checks, no reason for any of those that are receiving this ill-gotten or illicit wealth to actually ask where that money came from. And in so doing, strip that money of any identifying information, any ability to track it back to its original source, while nonetheless continuing to allow these oligarchs, these dictators, these kleptocratic regimes elsewhere to still control all of that money and do whatever they would like with it, all while plowing, again, trillions of dollars into things like the American economy. I mean, again, I'm talking about, certainly as an American, for largely American audiences, about this especially American transformation. I do think it's worth highlighting, though, this is a transformation we've seen take place elsewhere as
right.
well.
But Casey, why is it more lucrative, as you suggest, this kind of inshoring, this coming back to the U.S.? Why is it more lucrative to park your money in the U.S. in a shell company here in, you know, Nevada, say, as opposed to the Bahamas?
Yeah, no, Amal, that's also a great question in and of itself. You know, one of the reasons that so many of these oligarchs and these kleptocrats, these dictators come to the U.S. is because they have all these services freely available to them. Obviously, on the one hand, we have significant property rights and rule of law in the United States of America. But over the past two, three decades, we've also seen all of these services develop right here in the U.S. And again, across the country, not just in Washington, D.C., but around the country and state after state, that are providing all of these ease of access, all of these abilities to set up these offshoring networks right here in the United States. You have states, entire states, like Delaware, like Nevada, like Wyoming, like South Dakota, these smaller states that realize they have, on the one hand, the sovereign right to set up all these anonymous shell companies without any oversight from Washington, D.C. But on the other hand, they realize just how lucrative it actually is to provide all these offshoring networks to kleptocrats and oligarchs around the world. I mean, again, Molly, we're talking about trillions of dollars in illicit, ill-gotten, and suspect wealth that is always constantly looking for a home, and what we have seen sprout up in the United States of America, not least because the U.S. is simply the biggest economy in the world, but we have seen time and again these states, these jurisdictions, these industries opening their doors to all of this dictatorial and kleptocratic wealth, welcoming it in, stripping it of any identifying information, and then beyond that, allowing those oligarchs to continue controlling it. And as we now see, opening up this whole can of worms about national security crises and far beyond that we're only just beginning to deal with.
Well, does this give the U.S. potentially some leverage, as we've seen with the Russian situation, if the assets are on American soil, so to speak?
Yeah. So there is an element of this that in some of these oligarchic cases, at least out of Russia, maybe these oligarchs got a little bit out over their skis. Maybe they thought a little bit too highly of just how wide open the United States of America would be. Now, again, we're talking about a decades-long process that has been allowed to develop that we're only just beginning to clean up, or only just beginning to realize is a very real national security threat here in the U.S. And elsewhere. We've been able to target and identify some of these oligarchic assets. We've been able to identify some of their mansions, some of their yachts, some of their cars, and certainly these oligarchs don't like to see some of these assets actually taken from them. In a certain sense, there is some leverage that the U.S. has, but I think, Molly, the thing to remember is there are still so many industries in the United States of America, to say nothing of other countries elsewhere, that are still so drenched in anonymity, so wide open to these oligarchs, that we frankly have no idea where they've hidden the rest of their money. Because of the shell companies, because of things like anonymous real estate purchases, and again, not just luxury, condos and mansions, but also commercial real estate and apartment buildings around the country, to say nothing of private equity and hedge funds. We know the money is here, but we have such little insight into where it actually is that any leverage we might have is still just a fraction of what we should be able to actually have on our own end, let alone be able to identify.
Well, Casey, we've got a caller for you. We're going to go to the phones now. We've got Joe in Baraboo calling in with a question about the definition.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So, you're causing me some confusion here. Klepto in Latin, in all of my understanding, means to steal or to be a thief. And you keep calling them oligarchs, which are, to me, they're... they're probably the same thing, but by definition, not. Can you explain how your book is titled this way? And you haven't really talked about thievery yet.
Where the money's coming from? Yeah, thanks, Joe.
Yeah. Yeah, Joe, that's actually a fantastic question on your end. You know, one of the things that I write about a lot in the book is this notion of dirty money or illicit wealth. You know, one of the problems that Western policymakers, including in the U.S., have faced for years is that so much of this money tied to so many of these figures, these oligarchs, these dictators elsewhere, so much of it was gained perfectly legally insofar as we're talking about any kind of laws that exist in places like Russia or in places like China or in other dictatorships around the world. Technically speaking, these figures didn't break any laws whatsoever. Now, we know looking at this that oligarchs in places like Russia or other post-Soviet dictatorships, they gained all of their money through links to organized crime, gained all of their money through links to rising dictatorships, including those like Vladimir Putin in Moscow. If you look at it on its face, it's so clearly ill-gotten. That is to say, there wasn't any kind of fairness. There wasn't any kind of entrepreneurship. These aren't figures that are interested in investment or jobs creation. They simply used access to, again, organized crime links, links to dictators to seize so much of their wealth and then use these offshoring networks to move it into places like the United States. When we're talking about kleptocracy, we're talking about this level of gargantuan thievery that on the one hand, according to the laws of places like Russia, you know, they didn't do anything illegal. They're not going to jail for any of this seizure, for any of this asset accumulation, again, that they move and hide and launder in the West. What we're talking about is fair play at the end of the day. Did they gain fair access to these assets? It's very clear that they did not. It's very clear, again, their links to mafiosi, their links to dictatorships allow them to create these incredible war chests of assets that, again, they move into places like the US or Canada or the UK. So when we're talking about kleptocrats, we're talking about these figures that didn't build themselves up from nothing, but that seized what was out there or seized what was in national budgets or should have gone to roads or schools or hospitals. Well, these are the kind of typologies of dictators and oligarchs that we're talking about.
We'll talk more about this, Casey. Yes, yes. We're talking with investigative journalist Casey Michelle about his latest book, American Kleptocracy, How the U.S. Created the World's Greatest Money Laundering Scheme in History. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. What about this story is standing out to you or resonating? What's missing from this story? Call 1-800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenson for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're speaking with Casey Michelle, investigative journalist, author of the new book, American Kleptocracy, How the U.S. Created the World's Greatest Money Laundering Scheme in History. We'd love to hear what you think. 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Well, Casey, one thing I want to ask you about vis-a-vis the Russian assets that we've been hearing so much about is what actually happens to these assets that are seized by the government? I hear there's some effort in Congress here in the United States to potentially redirect those assets to Ukrainian relief efforts. Yeah. What have you heard about this?
Yeah, Molly, again, a great question. And something, frankly, that American, you know, policymakers have been dealing with for years and years, you know, long before the recent war in Ukraine is, you know, if you are able to identify an asset, you know, a mansion, a boat, some high-end artwork, and seize that from an oligarch or seize that from a dictator and his family, you know, we know that money should have gone to the people of, in this case, you know, places like Russia. But how do you return that money to that country, knowing full well that that regime is still in place? How do you actually have any kind of oversight that that money won't just be stolen yet again? There is no easy answer to this. This is something that, again, policymakers have been dealing with for years and years. And I will say it's been, frankly, maybe a breath of fresh air that folks in Congress out in Washington right now are considering something that's actually new in this space. That is to say, using the proceeds of all these seized mansions, seized yachts, seized high-end automobiles and the like to send not back necessarily to Russians themselves, even though that was the populace initially pilfered and pillaged, but to send it to the Ukrainians that are actually suffering on the ground from Russian aggression, send it to Ukrainian war efforts, Ukrainian relief efforts. Now, again, this is something that's only being discussed right now. We haven't seen any kind of details, let alone agreement on this, but this is something that's at least novel and new in this space. And certainly if it's returned to Ukraine or dedicated to Ukrainian efforts, it'd be a lot easier to get them the money than it would to be trying to set up some kind of new oversight committee in Russia and assume that that money won't just be stolen again by President Putin and his inner circle.
Right, right. Well, we've got another caller coming in for you. I want to go to Grant County, where Jay is on the line. Good afternoon, Jay.
Good afternoon. This is a very prudent topic. I want to thank the journalist for his hard work on this subject. I currently am working in Grant and Crawford County with a group that's trying to raise assistance for Ukrainian and Russian refugees who hopefully will be coming to this country for sanctuary. But my question is, in this kleptocratic society, how does illegal labor fit into the ill-gotten gains of these kleptocrats, and what can be done to stop it?
Yeah, I was going to say, Jay, that's a fantastic question. I mean, I'm not going to pretend to be any kind of expert as it pertains to the broader illegal labor sector, but what I can say, what I have worked on in the past, is that, you know, we're talking about these kleptocrats, we're talking about these oligarchs, we're talking about these dictators using these offshoring networks. And what we know is that so many companies, so many organized crime groups, so many other networks elsewhere that use and rely on things like illegal or undocumented labor also rely on these same exact offshoring networks. They rely on anonymous shell companies. They rely on anonymous investments to move and hide and launder their money and to throw investigators off the scent to make sure that any investigations into their networks are not actually followed through. So when I'm talking about these offshoring finance networks that, again, are provided in spades in the United States of America as well as elsewhere, it's not just the oligarchs that are taking advantage. It's those that are engaged in any kind of illicit or underhanded means, any kind of illegal activity. Anyone who has a little bit of dirty money burning holes in their pockets are also turning to all these offshoring sectors that in so many cases are still perfectly legal right here in the United States of America.
So what efforts, Casey, have there been to try to rein this in? Is there any interest? Have there been any efforts?
I will say, Molly, one of the silver linings to all of the horrors we've seen out of Ukraine in the past 4 or 6 weeks is that it frankly does feel like something of an inflection point, at least here in the U.S. right now, when it comes to tackling so many of these issues. I mean, I think there's, you know, just the fact that we're talking today, this broadening awareness that the fact that Russian oligarchs, among so many others, are turning to places like the U.S. to hide and launder so much of their money. And we're still very unclear about what exactly they're doing with all that money right here in the U.S. You know, just last year, the Biden administration finally elevated corruption to a core national security threat. That is to say, placing it on par with things like nuclear war and terror. And actually, just late last year, a few months before the invasion, the White House released the U.S.'s very first ever anti-corruption strategy document, which tackled so many of these issues we've been discussing today: anonymous shell company formation, anonymous real estate purchases, anonymous private equity and hedge fund investments, and on and on. Now, again, so much of this is rhetoric at this point. So much of this is simply saying the right things at the highest level of the American government. We still have to see how much of this actually translates into policy. But both out of the White House as well as Congress, just last year, Congress formed the Bipartisan Counter-Kleptocracy Caucus, which is kind of a mouthful.
That is a mouthful.
At the end of the day, he has been launching bill after bill to address so many of these issues. And again, all of this now culminating in the horrors and the bloodshed we've seen out of Ukraine. So, Molly, it's technically too early to tell. We have to wait and see. We have to keep the pressure up. But there is a reason that I am cautiously optimistic about where things are going in the U.S. and elsewhere moving forward.
Well, what about this part of the National Defense Authorization Act that you mentioned? What does that stand to do?
Yeah, so this was a bill that was passed in early 2021, the very first day of last year. You know, this is a bill that's passed every year, the National Defense Authorization Act. It has all kinds of defense spending mechanisms in there. But last year was something a little bit different. Last year had a specific provision within it called the Corporate Transparency Act, which finally, for the very first time when it passed, made the formation of anonymous shell companies in the U.S. illegal. That is to say, it finally ended the practice of forming anonymous shell companies in the United States of America. And again, as we've been talking about, Molly, the U.S. has been the go-to destination for anonymous shell companies. This is the basic bedrock of all these kleptocratic networks.
So that's
finally,
it? They're now banned? They're done?
Well, not quite yet. We're waiting for the final language, the final regulations to come out. And certainly, as we've seen before, these things can have exemptions. They can have loopholes. So we've been keeping the pressure up in Washington, or I should say campaigners have been keeping the pressure up in Washington to make sure any loopholes or exemptions are tight. But you know, I don't want to undersell how important this bill actually was. Year after year after year, this bill had been proposed and it failed. And finally, last year, we saw it actually pass. We're waiting for the final details, the final language. But boy, it was an important moment in this broader fight against kleptocracy right here in the U.S.
What other reform movements are you watching right now?
Well, I will say, to go back to that mouthful of a caucus that I mentioned just a moment ago, the Counter Kleptocracy Caucus, which has been launching bill after bill and is getting composed of equal number of Republicans and Democrats in Washington. One of the really important bills that they introduced, and this was in October, it hasn't yet passed, but this was a bill that was called the Enablers Act. And this is one of these kind of congressional acronyms that has a very long name that I can never remember, but shrunken down, the acronym is Enablers. And, you know, listeners may have heard this term over the past few weeks. When we're talking about enablers, these are the Americans on the ground that are working on behalf of the kleptocrats, the oligarchs, to move and hide and launder their money. These are the shell company operators, the real estate agents, the private equity investors, as well as increasingly American lawyers and law firms that can freely work and freely set up any of these offshoring networks that they want. This is a whole range of American professionals that don't have any kind of anti-money laundering requirements whatsoever and can work with any oligarch that they want. And if and when this bill passes, all it's going to do is place basic anti-money laundering checks, basic due diligence checks, to make sure that these Americans are no longer working in the service of kleptocrats or Russian oligarchs, or even for that matter, Ukrainian oligarchs, anyone from around the world that has a little bit of dirty money. It's going to be a significant step forward in making sure these American enablers can no longer be setting up these offshore networks that dictators, that oligarchs and kleptocrats require to hide and launder all of their ill-gotten gains.
Well, Casey, Michelle, we'll keep an eye on you and your work. And thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Molly, thanks so much for having me.
We've been speaking with Casey Michelle, writer, analyst, and investigative journalist. He's an adjunct fellow with the Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative. His latest book is called American Kleptocracy: How the U.S. Created the World's Greatest Money Laundering Scheme in History. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the future of COVID booster shots. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we speak with an activist with Down syndrome who works to improve the lives of all people with disabilities. We'll learn about her bill later in the program. But now, the FDA has authorized second COVID booster shots for anyone over the age of 50 and for some people with weakened immune systems. The agency says it wants to boost waning immunity among at-risk people ahead of more possible COVID waves. We're talking about the latest COVID news. We want to hear what you think. We're at 1-800-642-1234. Are you planning on getting a second booster shot? Give us a call. You can also email us ideas@WPR.org. On the line, we have Ajay Sethi, Associate Professor and Director of the Masters of Public Health Program at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Ajay, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Molly.
Well, I'm glad you could join us. Why did the FDA decide to authorize second boosters at this point?
Well, you know, the data from around the world are showing that when people, a few months out of the last booster, the antibody levels are waning. We're at a point in the pandemic in the U.S. where cases are clearly lowering, but we can't expect them to stay low for forever. We're going to have a future surge, and it's important to get the more vulnerable adults boosted again to protect them from severe illness.
And so why is the age 50? I mean, who should be getting the second booster?
Yeah, so I'll say that initially the thought was that getting a second booster for people who are 65 and older was a more obvious sort of cut point. The FDA lowered that to 50 because here in the US, about a third of people who are over 50 have some underlying condition that puts them at risk for severe illness. So the cutoff was lowered to be more conservative, simply because it really is important to avoid as many hospitalizations and worse outcomes when cases return.
So who is exactly eligible for this second booster? What types of people beyond those, anyone over 50?
Yeah, so people have an underlying condition, and that could be, for example, obesity. And we know a lot of people may fit that, may be obese. People with hypertension, diabetes, you know, other comorbidities that put them at risk, you know, for that severe illness. Also, of course, we can't forget there are a lot of people with weakened immune systems who are also eligible for being boosted again, simply because we know from the beginning that those individuals have some of the worst outcomes for COVID if they were to be infected.
And so is this becoming like the flu? Can we expect annual boosters?
You know, the FDA is going to be convening their advisory committee on April 6th to sort of think about a new framework for the future of boosters. So let's sort of wait and hear from them to see what the future may look like. I think we can expect to have recommendations to be vaccinated against COVID in the future as new variants emerge. Maybe there'll be a new strategy other than the platforms we're using right now, but time will tell whether we can improve what we have at the moment. They're excellent right now, but we could do better so we can potentially avoid repeated boosters. But having something in the future is going to be needed because we can expect this virus eventually to become a little seasonal, where more of the transmission is occurring during those winter months, like a lot of respiratory viruses, when a lot of respiratory viruses spread.
So I've read some articles about mixing and matching the varieties of vaccines, you know, mixing Moderna with Pfizer and vice versa to increase your immunity. What's your thought about that?
Yeah, there have been some studies done showing that when you mix the vaccine types, the types of platforms that are being used, you get some benefit. It stimulates the immune system in a way that you get sort of a broader array of antibodies that are produced. So the recommendation generally is to get boosted without a doubt. But if you were to mix and match, there is some added benefit to that from the data. You have a choice, and some people might choose a different vaccine for their booster if they felt like the first one produced reactions that they want to avoid this next time. So there's maybe lots of reasons for people to mix and match. But it seems like if you do that, you might get a higher quality response. And so there's some experts who will advocate for that.
Sure. But meanwhile, people with kids under 5 are still waiting. Where are we at with the research on a COVID vaccine for young kids?
Yeah, April's going to be a big month. Both Pfizer and Moderna have plans to submit their data to the FDA for review. Overall, for both of those vaccines, the safety profile looks good. That what really becomes the issue is whether or not you can get enough protection from the doses that are being given to children for each of those vaccines to make it worth sort of authorizing. And it looks like we will be able to do that, but we've got to look at the data first. The issue has been a bit of a roller coaster for the Pfizer vaccine, where they initially thought 2 doses would be enough, and then it turned out 3 doses might be needed. And that happens to be a vaccine where they're testing 1/10 of the adult dose for children under 5. So a low enough dose that you don't expect as many reactions if you give an adult dose to a child. But unfortunately, it wasn't as immunogenic. So a third dose is needed, and we'll have to see what the data reveal. For Moderna, they're aiming for two doses, a quarter of the dose that adults get, so a little bit higher, and therefore only two doses needed. And they indicate that it will be good data to warrant authorization, but again, we have to see what the FDA says. I think parents are just going to have to hang tight a little longer for a few more weeks, and we'll see what happens.
So what would you think is maybe best case scenario if the results come back good, if they're released in April? When would we see these appropriate levels of doses available, potentially hitting pharmacies?
Yeah, I think the supply is there. I think what's going to happen is parents will maybe be a little hesitant as to whether they want their young children vaccinated. We often, hear about the anxious parents who are waiting for the vaccines to be authorized. But when you look here in Wisconsin for 5 to 11-year-old children, their parents, have not necessarily decided to get them vaccinated. Only 27% of children 5 to 11 are vaccinated. So under 5, I imagine we might see even lower rates of vaccine uptake. And if children had infection during the Omicron spike, I imagine parents are confused as to what to do. I'll say that when the FDA reviews these data and the CDC makes recommendations, I hope parents recognize that, kids getting COVID is not the kind of thing we want to take a chance on. Kids can get long COVID, and getting vaccinated does protect them against that. And, if the data shows that they're safe, it'll be worth getting simply because the chances of getting COVID will be potentially high in a future surge.
Well, I'd like to go to the phones now. We have a caller in Slinger. Mike is on the line. Good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon. So my question is, I've gotten my three shots. My booster is at 5 months, and I want to get the fourth shot. And I've got Moderna, Moderna, and Moderna. So when I go to my provider, as soon as I can request a Pfizer. And will they do that, given that I've had a Moderna, Moderna, Moderna?
Good question. Thanks, Mike.
You can request a Pfizer, and you can get Pfizer as your next dose. And some people might say that's a good choice. Others might say stick to Moderna. So I think you'll have to talk to your provider to decide what's best for you, but you'll have both options available.
We're talking to UW-Madison epidemiologist Ajay Sethi about the FDA authorizing a second COVID booster and other COVID news. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Parents, love to hear from you. Are you planning to get your kids vaccinated against COVID once it's available? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're talking with UW-Madison epidemiologist Ajay Sethi about the COVID vaccine, additional boosters, vaccines for kids, the possibility of seasonal COVID shots. Love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. Ajay, I'm wondering what the status is currently of the BA2 variant that's currently circulating.
Yeah, so just this week, the CDC declared that this is now dominant, that somewhere between 51 and 59% of new infections is caused by BA2. And just last week, that was 39%. So surely, in a couple of weeks, we can expect almost all infections to be due to this new subvariant. It's a little bit more infectious, about a third to 50% more infectious than sort of the original Omicron that had caused a spike in January. And we can expect that to be the dominant form until another variant comes around. So even though cases are lowering right now, we now are dealing with a virus that's in the U.S. that's more infectious. So Over time, when we see that increase in cases, it'll be caused by BA2 or another variant in the future.
Well, And what's your advice as an epidemiologist for how people should, how seriously they should take this, considering that many people are vaccinated, many others are taking precautions, and some people are feeling quite done with this pandemic. How do you advise people to consider distancing, masking, other precautions?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, right. There's a lot of pandemic fatigue. We all feel it. And we are at a point right now where cases, you know, are on the lower side. We can expect that surge later on. So I think people should, you know, appreciate where we are at the moment and understand we do have a lot of immunity out there. There's some estimates by the CDC that 95% of Americans have some kind of immunity, whether that's from vaccination or previous infection. The problem is not everybody with any immunity has enough immunity to protect them against severe disease. So number one, everybody needs to be up to date on vaccination. There are too many people who just have not received all the doses recommended. Maybe they're completely unvaccinated. It's about 15% of society that's really holding out on that. And it's unfortunate. We also have about 15 million seniors, people 65 and older, who haven't been boosted yet after the primary series. And those are going to be the most vulnerable individuals the next time we have a surge. Now there's a recommendation for a second booster for people 50 and older. I'll say that, you know, in the meantime, we should not forget our masks. We should keep them nearby. Even though COVID is lower right now, it's not gone. And I personally choose to wear a mask indoors in public settings and try to avoid exceptionally large gatherings. And if I'm in the middle of a gathering, I don't worry as much as it was maybe last winter or during the winter. But, you know, I'm still cautious and I'm aware of the local epidemiology. When we start to see higher cases, it's important that we all become aware of that. So let's not forget that COVID is still out there.
Yes. Well, I want to go back to the phones. We've got a lot of calls coming in for you, Ajay. Let's go to Pewaukee next, where Peter's standing by. Good afternoon, Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I am 70 years old, and I've had the two vaccines and the booster. Would it be wise for me to extend this last booster up until the fall season so that the next booster would be working during the most vulnerable months of fall and winter?
Great question. Thanks.
Yeah, Peter has a good question. It's a question that we all have. I would say, you know, at 70, that's an older age. Getting a booster sooner is better than probably later, especially if he has underlying conditions, then really the time is now, since the last booster was some time ago. I recognize sort of why people would want to time the booster so that they have that protection when cases are increasing. Thing is, the cases are already out there at the moment. There's enough spread to be able to pick it up, and it's not a bad idea to get boosted. But I think when you have questions, it's important to just, you know, default by to talking to your doctor and deciding with them what the right choice might be. But the recommendation is to get it sooner than later.
Thanks. I want to go next to Richland Center, where we've got Paul on the line.
Hi, thank you very much. Your guest may not know the answer to this question, but for those of us that really want this second booster, who's going to pay for it? Because my wife heard that the government's not going to pay for this one because they don't have any money to pay for it. Is Medicare going to pay for this? Is our private insurance and supplements going to pay for it? Are we going to be paying for this out of pocket? And I'm sure it's not going to be inexpensive. And I guess I'm just wondering, who's paying for the second booster? I haven't heard anything talked about that.
Yeah, I think it's currently being debated in Congress. Ajay, what do you know?
Yeah, I'm not aware of people having to pay for second boosters right now. Indeed, federal funds are declining for supporting COVID testing and some other things. But I think right now that booster is paid for. We'll just wait over time to see, you know, what the federal government is going to do as there's greater demand for boosters and there's more uptake. But you can assume right now that it's going to be covered until we hear otherwise.
Thanks. Well, we've got more calls coming in. Let's go next to Madison. We've got Tom on the line. Good afternoon, Tom.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I'm around 60 years old, so I grew up with firsthand stories about polio and smallpox. And so the idea of going to get my booster shot or my, you know, any vaccine I needed just to go to, in, you know, to go to elementary school was just common. But today we have this politicization of vaccines and just common sense responses to COVID. And what can we do to overcome this politicization? Because, I mean, right now there's one party that's trying to kill all of the funding for COVID, and we can't deal with that. We need to have both parties on board.
Thanks, Tom. Ajay, what works? What works when you talk to people who may be hesitant?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know what works sometimes because there's been a lot of conversations about this, and we still have, you know, people who are hesitant. We still have a politicized pandemic. It's not surprising because the pandemic affects every aspect of our lives. It has been. And so it's not surprising it's become politicized. I think what's daunting is when every aspect of the way we handle the pandemic, whether it's testing or a new vaccine or monoclonal antibodies or something, there's an argument for everything that's based on ideology, unfortunately. I'm a big believer in just, you know, chipping away with one conversation at a time with people who may not agree with you. It takes patience, it takes a lot of listening, and just being open that, just remember that everybody who makes decisions bases their decisions on what they feel to be true, even if it's different from what you feel to be true. I think we just have to sort of be patient with each other, have these conversations. And, you know, the caller also talked about, you know, pandemics of the past. And I'll say that a lot of people do change their tune when they lose a loved one to COVID or they experience severe illness. It's a terrible way to learn that lesson, but it's another way where people do change their minds.
Yes. Well, let's go next to Milwaukee, where we have Tom on the line. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm wondering if the constant need for boosters is largely contingent upon the fact that most of the world has not been immunized, and so we keep getting new variants.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, you know, the need for another booster is based mainly because the antibodies wane after the third boost or that third shot. Indeed, we do want to stop COVID from spreading around the world, but that is going to take time. That's the reason why we're always vigilant for future variants, because the virus is still out there spreading and mutating and evolving. But the need for another dose is really to boost the antibody levels simply because that's what's required. They're calling it a second booster, but you really could look at that first booster as the third dose in the primary series. We're making these decisions in real time based on scientists coming in real time. And it's clear that three doses is definitely needed to get protection. And now this additional dose called the second booster is going to help for the more vulnerable people.
All right, let's squeeze in one last question. We've got Mona in Appleton. You're on the air. Good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering, couple things, mixing the seasonal flu shot with the COVID, if they're going to combine that, I would not be on board with that because I had a pretty harsh reaction to my second Pfizer, but my booster 7 months later, I did not. I was eligible. I got it when I was eligible 7 months later. And also, as far as I'm 60 and I don't have any underlying health conditions, do I really need a fourth booster?
Gotcha.
I don't have the underlying. And how long can I wait?
Gotcha. Yeah, we've just got a minute left. Ajay, what do you think?
I'll say in general that the FDA won't authorize any future vaccines where the safety profile is not in favor of people getting it. So if there's a combined vaccine in the future, it'll only be authorized if the reactions are, you know, things that we can handle. I totally respect to having a bad reaction for one of the doses. My third dose for Pfizer wasn't great, but my first two were fine. sometimes you can prepare yourself for that dose, you know, just avoiding caffeine, avoiding alcohol, getting good rest, and that can maybe help. There's a lot of anecdotal data out there, but getting that fourth dose is really important if you're vulnerable for severe disease. So I would recommend that.
Well, thank you so much. That's all the time we have, but thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Molly.
I've been speaking with Ajay Sethi, Associate Professor and Director of the Masters of Public Health Program at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Lee Rayburn speaks with a Wisconsin journalist back from reporting on the Ukrainian refugee crisis from the streets of Poland. Well, the spring migration has begun, and apparently that includes flamingos, too. Wildlife officials have confirmed reports of a flamingo that escaped from a Kansas zoo 17 years ago. It was a dark and stormy night back in Wichita in 2005 when two flamingos made a break for it. One flamingo was never to be seen again. The other escapee, known only as 492, has since been seen over the years up and down the country, including Texas, Louisiana, and yes, even here in Wisconsin. Officials say they know it's the same bird because of a distinctive leg band. Zoo officials say they don't plan to recapture this free bird. So keep an eye out next time you're on Bascom Hill. I'm Molly Stentz. In for Rob Ferret, you're listening to Central Time.